Now, Leo had a superhuman affinity for animals. He was the St. Francis of the projects. Though pets were not allowed in the projects, people had them nonetheless. Folks would bring their pets, the crippled dog or cat, and somehow Leo had his healing way with them. They'd drop their crutches and be good as new. I just met a veterinarian at a talk I gave, so I called him. He hired Leo right away, first to clean up the dog poop and the cages. Then Leo learned to bathe the animals and even give them shots. Now he's a supervisor at an animal shelter. It wasn't long before Leo had got himself one of them careers. It was worth the wait. Sometimes you need to walk in the gang member's door in order to introduce him to a brand new door. You grab what he finds valuable and bend it around something else, a new form of nobility. You try to locate his moral code and conform it to a new standard that no longer includes violence and the harboring of enemies. Anniversaries of the dead from Barrios are honored and commemorated with great care. This was certainly true in my early days, when gangs were just beginning to see fatalities. These days, anniversaries seem to be less recalled than they were 20 years ago. As the number of homicides accelerates, only the families and close friends still seem to remember. A homie named Psycho, 19, has been dead a month, and 15 of his homies are insistent on going to Resurrection Cemetery to mark this 30-day moment. I pile them all in the parish van, and we find the nearly fresh dirt and turf where we had gathered a month before. The family has yet to secure enough funds to place a piedra with his name, but the homies know where he is resting in peace. In fact, this becomes, for homies, the veritable last name of all their dead. Psycho, rest in peace. We went to visit the other day Trigger, rest in peace, Mom, a homie might say. And it is very common for young women to identify themselves on the phone this way. This is Blanca, sniper, rest in peace, baby's mama. We encircle the grave, and no one speaks. The homies stand with their hands in their pockets and stare at the ground, this resting place. I look the other way as homies sneak off and steal flowers from other graves and place them on the ground in front of us. They smoke, and several of them light a frajo for Psycho, and then rest it burning on a tuft of grass below. Carlos, a skinny and impossibly tall homie, not yet 18, starts to sob. The circle of us surrounding Psycho's marker is complete, and Carlos is now convulsing with a renewed grief, inconsolable in what has now become full-body heaving and wailing. I can sense the circle is disquieted by this. Footfalls shift and tap, and though no one looks at Carlos, they are all clearly uncomfortable with this display. I don't sense that they judge it false or inappropriate, only a manifestation of some gate they would rather not have opened. Sensing the signal the group is sending, I put my arm around Carlos and walk him away from the circle. He is awash in mocos and tears and seems not at all concerned with mopping up after himself. He sobs resolutely while I stand there with him, arm draped lightly over his shoulder. There is more than grief here. He tells me, between his insucks of breath and jags of crying, that he was with Psycho earlier in the day, before he was killed that night. Just the two of them, walking in the hood. It occurred to Psycho to tell Carlos of a premonition. He knows he is going to die soon. But if anything happens to me, he tells Carlos, I know you will take care of everything. Carlos has been carrying this for 30 days and has told no one. Taking care of everything only means one thing in gang parlance. Kill the one who kills me. It means revenge, fast and sure and clear. Carlos is a pimply teenager who drank in excess and joined a gang some years earlier when he discovered that the man he thought was his father was in fact his stepdad. The earthquake of this revelation sent Carlos into an odd freefall, hardened anything that was soft, and somehow lodged him tight in this crevice of hard drinking and serious hanging with gangsters. At the core, though, he frankly didn't want to carry the burden of avenging this death. "And you have taken care of everything," I whispered to him, trying desperately to find another door for him to exit. "I mean, who organized all the car washes that paid for his funeral? You did. Who has been so present to Psycho's mom and sister during this whole time? It was you. You hardly ever left their side, comforting them. Who has helped me more in calming down the homies so they don't do something stupid and regrettable? Only you, Doc. Only you." I lean on him and plead my case, my closing argument. "In fact, son, I think you may be the downest vato I've ever known. Neta, I mean, you took care of everything." Homies get stuck so often in a morass of desesperación, both the impasse writ large and the ordinary mud of inertia. Few can conjure an image of something better. Joey is one of these stuckies. At 21 years old, he seems eternally adolescent, and he has mastered the art of hanging out. He is a cherubic-cheeked, chunky kid who looks forever 12. He is half-hearted even in his sporadic forays into selling crack. He sells enough to feed himself at McDonald's and resume the ardors of just kicking it. The assertion in Freakonomics is true enough that, by and large, very few homies are getting rich selling drugs. No one's buying the home in La Puente. Certainly not Joey. I try frequently to shake Joey out of the stupor of sleeping late, slinging a little, kicking it with the homies, checking in with his hyena, and enduring the woofing of his grandma. His more purposeful older brother Memo sums up Joey's level of maturity. "He always be acting his shoe size, 8. This shiftlessness has become his life, and for all the pointing I make in the general direction of possible exits, all are politely shrugged away. Joey shows up one morning at my office, and his smile seems to come from a deeper, surer place than usual. "Get ready to be proud of me," he says, settling in. "Okay, I'm sitting down. Fire away." "You're talking to an employed vato right now."
"Serio, dog? Felicidades. So where are you working?"
Joey turns around to make sure no one is lurking nearby. "Now that's the thing, dog," he says, lowering his voice and moving closer to me. "You have to promise not to tell the homies." I agree. "Well, I'm working at Chuck E. Cheese," he tells me.
"Well, gosh, that's great, son,"
I assure him, feeling my nose grow.
"But what do you do there?"
"But that's the thing, G. You can't tell the homies." I nod.
"I'm the rat."
The mascot, a rat, is Chuck E. Cheese.
"Wow, I mean, that's great."
I try and convince him and myself.
"No, it ain't. It sucks. The rat suit is all hot, and it be humming in there, and the kids be bugging. They be pushing you and putting chicle on you. Pero, mijito, I'm proud of you," I tell him. "But what woke you up enough to go apply for a job?"
Joey gets sober and clear-eyed, and there is no doubting for him how he was led to this moment and place and rat suit. "In 2 months, my son's gonna be born. I want him to come into the world and meet his father. A working man. That'll do it." I always thought Bugsy was the perfect moniker for Jaime. He bugged. You could set your watch by the predictable post-jail visit. Bugsy was bound to ask for something minutes after rolling out of the county jail on Bouchet Street. He was tiny but scrappy, and though in his early 20s, having seen his slice of terror and trauma, he had old man's eyes. Since we have been in exactly this scene countless times before, Bugsy moves right to it. "Here's the deal. Check out my shoes, G. I mean, they toe up from the flow up. Do me that bottle, yeah? And buy me some shoes?" I figure the sheer repetition of this moment with Bugsy should come at some price to him. "Okay, I'll buy you the shoes. But first you have to answer this question correctly." Bugsy seems game. "First I have to set the stage before I ask the question. I am charmed by Bugsy's intensity. His attention is total." One day the phone rings and one of our workers, a 16-year-old homie named Manuel, answers it. "Homeboy Industries, how may I help you?" Well, it's a collect call and we always accept collect calls, so Manuel does. On the other end, calling from county jail, is a 20-year-old from an enemy neighborhood to Manuel, though neither knows this yet. "May I help you?" Manuel says to the 20-year-old. The jailbird growls at him, "Who's this?" Now, Manuel thinks I could say, "Lucky," my gang placa, but nah. So he says, "Manuel." And the 20-year-old gets even more low-key. "Where you from?" A provocative question wanting to identify his gang. Manuel says, "Please hold," turns to Norma, my assistant, and says, "Norma, could you handle line 3, please?" Bugsy could not lean in more. To do so would put him on my side of the desk. "Now," I continue, "that's the setup, and here's the question. Which of these two vatos was the real man? The 16-year-old or the guy who was 20? Bugsy leans back, and now he knows he's getting a new pair of shoes. "Oh, come on, gee," he half laughs. "That's easy." "Well, then," I say, "who?" "Well, obviously the 16-year-old. "Why him and not the older vato?" "Well, 'cause the 16-year-old didn't play that little kid stuff, that gang-banging masa," he says, as dismissive as he could be of such behavior. "Very good, my dog," I say to him. "I've got good news and bad news for you. The good news, you're getting brand new shoes. The bad news, you know the 20-year-old vato calling from jail? That was you, cabron, when you called collect 2 months ago." Bugsy winces slightly. "Yeah, I sort of thought that's where the story was going." There is nothing once and for all in any decision to change. Each day brings a new embarking. It's always a recalibration and a reassessing of attitude and the old tired ways of proceeding, which are hard to shake for any of us. These are the calls I cannot bear getting. They're shooting in Aliso. This one comes at midday, and I'm sitting in my office, our reception room filled with homies in line to see me. I excuse myself and race to my car. The details are these. Two gang members have entered enemy turf and are crossing out their enemies' placas, their gang monikers, when a group of enemigos spot them, holler, and begin to run toward them. One of the two invading homies pulls out a gun and shoots wildly, attempting to dissuade the approaching enemies on foot. No one is hurt, but a bullet does travel to our alternative school, DMA, on Mission Road, punctures a window, and a shard of shattered glass slightly cuts the face of a mother who is in the school's office. She's taken to the hospital. I'm not sure why I even go to the projects when I receive one of these calls. I suppose you go because you're called. I'm never entirely sure what people's expectation of me might be. You mainly just stand with folks as they catch their breath and wait for their blood pressure to settle. This day, traveling west down First Street with considerable speed, I see Johnny and Bear on the wrong side of the street in enemy territory. They are shirtless, running and desperate to get to the right side of the street. I know immediately these must be our marauding spray-painting gang members. I get confirmation of this when they spot me driving toward them and I can read their lips. Oh, shit! They stop and bolt down an alley. This incenses me. Suddenly, I am both Starsky and Hutch. I'm driving like I've placed a flashing red light on the top of my car, careening down the alley, narrowly nicking garbage cans, and swerving to miss refuse and car parts. I see the shirtless ones take a left, and I follow. I don't know why I'm doing this. Quite apart from the infuriating midday shooting is the fact that they run when they see me. This is new and just pisses me off. I barrel out of the alley and they're gone. I circle the neighborhood for some time and give up. I go to the scene of the shooting and calm down the aggrieved homies who have had their neighborhood dissed and check in with the school and make sure they are rebounding. I get a report of the woman with the piece of flying glass lodged in her cheek, and I go back to where I think I might find Johnny and Bear. I park and walk and turn a fortuitous corner, and there they are, sitting on the front porch of Bear's girlfriend's house. They get to their feet at the sight of me, and I hold my hand to stop their flight and say quickly, "Nope," as in, "Oh, hell no, you are not going anywhere." I summon them off the porch and signal them to join me by the short gate and fence that fronts the property. They are still shirtless, still sweating from their great escape. "Don't you ever run from me again." I begin calmly and stay in this tone, though I'm as enraged as any father snatching his four-year-old out of the street as a car approaches. You don't realize how grateful you are that your kid is safe. You are just furious at what is wandering out there could have brought you all. I came to always feel this outsized stress coming from some deep primordial place within me, wanting to protect and yet feeling a Garpian dread that the undertow is strong today. Pre-traumatic stress syndrome, if you will. Even now, I spend much of the day just bracing myself. It's infuriating and death-defyingly stressful when, consciously or no, the kids you love cooperate in their own demise. Johnny and Bear predictably have more remorse about fleeing me than they do about their foray into enemy turf. I have pieced things together enough to know that Johnny was the lone shooter. I turn to him and know exactly how I want this conversation to end. "Oh, by the way, Johnny, I thought maybe you'd want to know. No one was seriously hurt when you shot just now." He neither protests nor proclaims his innocence. He just continues to listen with some intensity. "A woman was standing in the school office when one of your bullets shattered the window. A piece of glass cut her face, and she went to the hospital. She'll be okay. Just thought you'd like to know." I walk away and say nothing more in my leave-taking. Then before I get very far, I come back. "Gosh, Johnny, I almost forgot this part. The woman with the cut face? Yeah, that was your mom, son. Your mom. She'll be okay. Just thought you'd like to know." Johnny blanches at this, and all his blood drains right out of him, leaving him white and speechless. It only feels like Johnny and Bear think this is all a game, placing themselves in danger, recklessly firing a gun, holding in no regard the lives of so many. The outsider will invariably draw this conclusion. Yet, they are comrades in despair, and their inability to care for their own lives consistently plays itself out in the abandonment of all reason and surely all hope. There is no force in the world better able to alter anything from its course than love. Ruskin's comment that you can get someone to remove his coat more surely with a warm, gentle sun than with a cold, blistering wind is particularly apt. Meeting the world with a loving heart will determine what we find there. We mistakenly place our trust too often in the righteousness of our wind, though we rarely get evidence that this ever transforms anything. Inmate and guard alike at Folsom Prison, where I did a stint as chaplain, always said the same thing about the other. I don't want them to mistake my kindness for weakness. Sooner or later, we all discover that kindness is the only strength there is. I can remember listening to a kid at a probation camp read at Mass from 1 Corinthians 13. If you've been to as many weddings as I have, you go numb as you hear, love is patient, love is kind, love is blah, blah, blah. Your mind floats away. You start wondering if the Dodgers won last night and remind yourself to move your clothes from the washer to the dryer. But this kid started to read it like it mattered, and it, as the homies would say, woke my ass up proper. He looked out at everyone and proclaimed with astounding surety, love never fails. And he sat down, and I believed him. Every day you choose to believe this all over again, and want only to live as though the truth were true. In my early crazy days doing this work with gangs, I will admit I was totally out of whack. I'd ride my bike in the middle of the night in the projects, trying to put out fires, put that Uzi down, now you sure you want to shoot that guy? Trying to save lives is much like the guy spinning plates on Ed Sullivan, attempting to keep them from crashing to the floor. I'd look for wobblers. Who was about to smash into a million pieces? And then I'd be frantic to keep that homie from self-destructing. It was crazy-making, and I came close to the sun, to the immolation that comes from burning out completely in the delusion of actually saving people. I took a break in 1992, and in the stillness of meditation and the sweetness of surrender, I found a place of balance and perspective. I found consolation in a no-doubt apocryphal story of Pope John the 23rd. Apparently, at night he'd pray, I've done everything I can today for your church, but it's your church and I'm going to bed. Before, I guess I never really went to bed, available 24/7 to respond to any call and at the ready to talk homies off the ledge. A touchstone story happened not long ago after I returned from my time off. A homie, Pedro, who works for me now as a case manager, was then a greatly troubled kid, filled with a measured rage and resentment he submerged beneath first heavy drinking and then crack cocaine. Pedro, among the gentlest and most kind-hearted of homies, disappeared eventually into his own netherworld of substance abuse. He was seemingly oblivious that he had left us at all. Daily, I'd see him and offer rehab. He'd gently decline with a sweetness that never grew defensive. Oh, thanks, G, but I'm okay. You never stop asking, and sometimes the no-matter-whatness prevails. And so it did with Pedro. I drove him to his rehab north of Los Angeles, and he began the long, hard, slow work of returning to himself. 30 days into his stay there, his younger brother Jovan, enfeebled by similar demons and displaced in the same chemical dependence, did what homies explicitly don't ever do. He put a gun to his head and an end to his pain. Homies, more often than not, just decide to put themselves in harm's way when things turn bleakest. They just take a stroll into their enemy's domain. Gangbanging is how they commit suicide, and any shooter is never going on a mission, foray into enemy territory, intending to kill, but rather hoping to die. Jovan's homies were unfamiliar then with this new language, so direct, bypassing the slow dance with danger that eventually gets you to the same end. I call Pedro, and he is, of course, devastated. But since he is now 30 days sober, he allows the pain passage to his core and doesn't permit the hurt to waste time, languishing in some distant way station. He lets all the sadness in, and this is new. I schedule to pick him up for the funeral and make a point to emphasize that I'll be driving him back right after the burial. Course, G, I want to come back here. I make the trek to the mountaintop and feel inadequate, as I always do, in accompanying such loss, especially as huge as this one felt. Emily Dickinson writes, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul, that sings the song without the words, and never stops at all." I've come to trust the value of simply showing up and singing the song without the words. And yet, each time I find myself sitting with the pain that folks carry, I'm overwhelmed with my own inability to do much more than stand in awe, dumbstruck by the sheer size of the burden, more than I've ever been asked to carry. Pedro is out front waiting for me, and we greet each other with abrazos and a minimum of words. We hop in the car. Any worry I have about what to say gets punctured by Pedro's insistence to tell me about a dream he had the night before. "It's a trip, G. I had this dream last night, and you were in it." And in this dream, Pedro and I are in this large empty room, just the two of us. There are no lights, no illuminated exit signs, no light creeping in from under the doors. There are no windows. There is no light. He seems to know that I am there with him. A sense, really, though we do not speak. Suddenly, in this dark silence, I retrieve a flashlight from my pocket and push it on. I find the light switch in the room on the wall, and I shine this narrow beam of light on the switch. I don't speak. I just hold the beam steady, unwavering. Pedro says that even though no words are exchanged, he knows he is the only one who can turn this light switch on. He thanks me for happening to have a flashlight. He makes his way to the switch, following the beam with, I suppose, some trepidation. He arrives at the switch, takes a deep breath, and flips it on. The room is flooded with light. He is now sobbing at this point in the telling of the dream. And with a voice of astonishing discovery, he says, "And the light is better than the darkness." As if he did not previously know this to be the case. He's weeping, unable to continue. Then he says, "I guess my brother just never found the light switch." Possessing flashlights and occasionally knowing where to aim them has to be enough for us. Fortunately, none of us can save anybody. But we all find ourselves in this dark, windowless room, fumbling for grace and flashlights. "You aim the light this time, and I'll do it the next." The slow work of God. And you hope, and you wait for the light. This astonishing light. Chapter 6. Jurisdiction. The walk to my office at 1916 East 1st Street used to take me 5 minutes. I'd pass 2nd Street School and watch parents cling to the chain-link fence, transfixed by their kids as they filed into the school building. They wouldn't leave their posts until they saw their kids walk into class. Closer to my office and before the alley was Junior's apartment. In his 40s, Junior drank 40s all day. He'd be nursing a large cold one even at 7:30 a.m. as I arrived to open Homeboy Industries. Most days, you'd see him hanging out his window on the second floor, shirtless, no matter the weather. He was wiry and feisty, and despite my 2 decades of urging recovery on him, alcohol didn't seem to obscure his goodness. It pickled it. It was as out there as his shirtless torso surveying the world from the second floor. One day, as I'm walking past, lost in my own thoughts, I failed to see him. Then after I had gone beyond his apartment in the alley, Junior screams full throttle, "Love you, G-Dog!" This stops me in my tracks, as it does a few other people. I'm always startled by the ready way folks and homies tell you that they love you. This was not always so available to me in my own Irish Catholic background. You knew people loved you, but words never brought you to that knowledge. In the barrio, people tell you. I retrace my steps, and I'm now standing under his windowsill looking up. "Thank you, Junior. That was a very nice thing to say." Junior waves me on as if papally blessing me as my day begins. "Oh, come on now, G, you know," he says, spinning his hand in a circular motion. "You're in my jurisdiction." I can't be entirely sure what Junior meant, except for the fact that we all need to see that we are in each other's jurisdictions, spheres of acceptance, only all the time. And yet there are lines that get drawn and barriers erected, meant only to exclude. Allowing folks into my jurisdiction requires that I dismantle what I have set up to keep them out. Sometimes we strike the high moral distance of judgment, moving our protected jurisdictions far from each other. This is also largely the problem in the groupthink of gangs. They just can't seem to see one another as residing in the same jurisdiction. "We are the guys who hate those guys," is the self-defining assertion of every gang. The challenge is getting them to abandon the territory of their gang and replace it with a turf more ample, inclusive, and as expansive as God's own view of things. In the late 80s, the gangs of Pico Aliso housing projects largely just said no to drugs. They'd sell them, but didn't use them. Hard drug usage made you liable to provoke conflict with otherwise friendly gangs, or if you sold drugs, it would upset your business. One gang in particular was an exception, and PCP was its drug of choice. Members of this gang would walk up the hill to the clock store, an abandoned tienda with a looming clock stuck at a little past 3. They would score their PCP, paying for dips, dousing their cigarettes in little vials of the drug, maybe once, perhaps twice if they had the money. Then they would return to their barrios with their cools and get high in the safe confines of their neighborhood. One evening, Flaco and 3 of his confreres make the trip to the clock store. But instead of delaying their gratification, they get high right there. This leads them to take the shortcut home by traversing the 101 freeway. When I get to the hospital that evening, the doctor standing by Flacco's bed peers down on the unconscious 21-year-old and renders his verdict. "I have never seen a body hit with such impact and still live to talk about it." This apparently is the good news. The bad? The car had crushed Flacco's right leg and ripped his left arm clean off his body. I hadn't slept much that night and was decidedly, as the homies would say, in a bad move the next day. I was just barely getting accustomed, at that stage in my ministry, to the daily dread of disastrous things that always seem to befall those who are suspended already by the thinnest of lifelines. I'm heading out of the church parking lot, walking towards Pico Gardens, and I see a clubhouse of gangsters congregating by the church's bell tower. This is not uncommon, as the church has become a welcoming space for them. This gang is an enemy to Flacco's gang. I walk past and greet them, and as I turn the corner, I can hear one of their group, Gato, say loudly, "I'm glad that shit happened to Flacco last night." The gathering explodes in laughter. I double back. I am instantly in a red-faced fury. The conventional wisdom in working with gangs would say that you never put a homie on the front page. I do not care about this at the moment. I get in Gato's face and give him a banner headline. "Sabes que, mijito? I love you and I am down for you. And I love Flacco and I am down for him." Now I am nearly nose to nose with Gato. And I say, "Don't you ever talk that way in front of me again." This is a risky confrontation, but I'm too pissed off to care. "Spansa, G," he says, in a voice 10 years younger than the one he used minutes before. Some of the others chime in and share the remorse. "Sorry, G. Come on, G. Don't be mad." Homies are good on regret, bad on restraint. I barrel past them all and resume my march to the projects. I've had a handful of moments like this in my 2 decades working with homies. There were times when the futility and irrationality of the gang mindset threw me into this frustrated place, which would occasionally play itself out like the scene above. Sometimes you just can't think of much else to do but shake your fist and get red in the face. The next day I'm driving out of the parking lot, and right outside is Gato. He flags me down, and I lower the window. "Hey, G," he says, "give me a ride, yeah, to my ladies." I tell him to get in and buckle up. I can feel his desire to repair what transpired the day before, and I am humbled at his taking the lead in this. "Where are you going?" he asks. "To the hospital," I say. "To visit Flacco." Gato says nothing. We sit in something of an icy silence. His lady lives only in Pico Gardens, so it's not much of a trip, and the silence is bearable. When we arrive, he thanks me, shakes my hand with the homie handshake, and opens the door to leave. He hardly makes it outside when he sits back down. "Do me a paro, G," he says. "You tell Flacco that Gato from so-and-so gang says, cuo, and that I hope he gets better." "I will do that," I tell him with a smile and real admiration for the stretch this represents. Gato makes to get out of my car again, then rapidly returns to take his seat. "Gee," he says, "I mean, don't tell my homies I said that." I tell him that his secret is safe with me. Sometimes you're thrown into each other's jurisdiction, and that feels better than living, as the Buddhists say, in the illusion of separateness. It is in this place where we judge the other and feel the impossibility of anything getting bridged. The gulf too wide and the gap too distant. The walls growing higher, and we forget who we are meant to be to each other. Somewhere in the jurisdictional locale where judgment used to claim us, a remarkable commonality rushes in, and the barriers that exclude are dismantled. The poet Rumi writes, "Close both eyes to see with the other eye." But finding and seeing beyond our sense of being separate, our mutuality with the other is hard won. Bridging the gulf of mutual judgment and replacing it with kinship is tricky indeed. Chepa and Richie need to get out of town. They haven't committed a crime, but it's just a matter of time before America's Most Wanted comes calling. Their constant risky behavior and failure to ever be cautious has an expiration date. They are from the same gang and walking the tenuous line that separates them from bona fide trouble and innocent enough kicking it. I think they need a momentary change of venue. I've been invited to give several talks in Bakersfield and Ridgecrest, so I snatch up Chep and Richie for the road trip. We'll stay at my sister Maureen's house in Ridgecrest. Chep and Richie have their own rooms and their own beds, a first. And my sister has waiting for them their own personal towels with Richie and Chepe embroidered on each. We break up our trip with dinner at Coco's, a restaurant a notch above Denny's and a notch below, well, every place else. A very imposing woman with a missile silo hairdo is serving as our hostess this evening. She stands behind this reception counter and glowers at the three of us. Well, really only at Chep and Richie, shaved heads, tattooed, and in all their baggy clothes gangster finery. I hold up three fingers to indicate the number in our party, and she budges, not at all, from her rock-solid mad dogosity. I play charades with her. Whole idea. Three people, sit at table, eat food. Each concept comes with its own accompanying gesture. I know exactly the origin of her displeasure, and I volley some of my own right back at her. I judge her just as surely as she judges them. Barriers that exclude all around, please. Finally, she blinks, grabs at three menus, and emerges from behind the desk, waving at us to follow her. She sighs with exasperation, not one bit happy, that we have chosen Coco's for our dining pleasure. We follow the hostess's beehive through the restaurant, and let's just say we apparently are no longer in East L.A. All the diners stop what they're doing, silverware suspended in midair, and a disquieting silence descends on the place. All eyes turn toward us as we move uncertainly through the divided sides of tables and customers. Richie stage whispers, "Everybody's looking at us." I douse his concern. "Don't be ridiculous." Everybody was looking at us. We get to our table in the nether bowels of the place, way beyond where the others are enjoying their meals until we showed up. "We don't belong here," Chepe whispers as we settle in our booth in the project section of Coco's. "We should go someplace else." "What are you talking about?" I say, trying to dampen their paranoia. "There's just pure rich white people here," Richie pleads. "Yeah," Chepe clarifies. "Them people who be eating great poupon and shit. Would you guys just relax? Our money is just as green as their money." Richie excuses himself and delicately announces that he needs to take a leaky asshole. Maybe there was one or possibly two people in the restaurant who actually didn't hear him broadcast where he was going. While he's gone, the waitress deposits a slew of menus, the special menu, the summer menu, the sizzling platter menu, the regular old menu. When Richie slinks back into the booth, he eyes this laminated array set before him and asks, "Are these the things?" "The things?" I helpfully ask. "You know, the things." "The menus?" "Oh, come on, G," Richie says with a sigh. "You know I don't speak rich." This was their first time in a restaurant where you actually sat down, a waitress came to you, and you didn't have to order by pointing at a luminous plastic picture of a cheeseburger. Variations on this theme have always been bountiful. I've had homies in restaurants actually think they needed to clear the table after eating. Once a homie said, "Can I give a tip to the waitress?" And when she arrived, he said, "Just say no to drugs." His homie adding, "Don't run with scissors." The restaurant, to the gang member, is a foreign land indeed. Our waitress is an entirely different story from the frozen and awkward reception we seem to be getting from everybody else. She puts her arms around the fellas, calling Cheppy and Richie sweetie and honey and bringing them refills, and we didn't even have to ask. With extra this and more of that and supplying the tapatio on demand, she is Jesus in an apron. Later, as we walk to the car, they talk about our waitress. She was firme. Yeah, she treated us like we were somebody. We have a chance sometimes to create a new jurisdiction, a place of astonishing mutuality, whenever we close both eyes of judgment and open the other eye to pay attention, reminding each other how acceptable we are and lavishly providing free refills and all the tapatio you need. Suddenly, we find ourselves in the same room with each other, and the walls are gone. One of the great fonts of sadness in the prison system and the youth authority in California is the heightened division between the races. At the reception center of the youth authority in Norwalk, SRCC, once a month I celebrate two masses back to back in a multi-purpose center. At roughly 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. on a Sunday, the wards are brought in and sit on metal folding chairs. They are almost all Latino. In the early days, my helpers, those who set up for Mass and did the readings, were Jerome, African-American, Larry, Caucasian, and Juan, Latino. They were great friends, and their bond seemed to jar somewhat the racial boundaries so tightly held in these places. When I first arrived there, they schooled me on my responsibilities and seemed to confuse my first Mass at SRCC with my first Mass ever. "We will have the offertory," Larry explains, as if, as the homies say, this was my first barbecue. Juan picks up, "The offertory is when we bring you the gifts." Juan enunciates like I'm not a native speaker in any language. "The gifts," Jerome brings us home, "are the bread and the wine." I'm acting as if I'm taking mental notes. Bread, wine, tell me more. "And then," Jerome says, proceeding, "I will come over with a bowl, and I will pour water over your fingers." He leans in furtively and manages a whisper, "So, you know, you can wash your iniquities." I told him I was able to scrub the heck out of my iniquities before I got there, but thanks anyway. Once before Mass, the Catholic chaplain, Tom Molitaire, tells me that Juan is going to sing a solo after communion. We had never had singing in all my time coming to this place, and I congratulate Juan before the Mass begins. The moment arrives, and Juan steps up to the microphone and begins to sing a cappella. It's jaw-droppingly bad. What comes from this kid's pipes is some vague sound of small animal torture. We are all stunned. I quickly check the faces of the couple hundred wards sitting there. They can be, shall we say, a tough bunch. They are agog, and the singing is so bad that the part of their brains that handles laughter doesn't get the message in time. They stare flabbergasted. The first Mass ends, and I find myself assiduously avoiding any contact with Juan. I do not have a clue what words to put together on his post-communion canción. Soon enough, the seats are filled again, and Mass number 2 is launched. Now, I just presume Juan won't attempt this a second time. But sure enough, communion ends, and Juan steps up to the microphone with seemingly no lack of confidence. And he accomplishes something I would not have thought possible. It is worse than the first time around.
It is an outtake from American Idol. Again, no cat calls or giggles, not even shifting in seats. The congregation is frozen comatose in the sheer awfulness of it. Now, after this mass, there's no avoiding it. I have to say something to Juan without failing the lie detector test. Juan, I say, with my hand on his shoulder, and Larry and Jerome closing the circle around him. You know, it takes a lot of courage to read in front of people, but it takes even more courage to get up and sing in front of people. Then Jerome steps up and places his arm over Juan's shoulder. And it takes even more courage to get up and sing when your ass can't sing. In an instant, I am preparing myself to break up a fight. But just as quickly, the three of them have a meltdown of laughter, and soon they are on the floor of this multi-purpose center, convulsing and smacking each other. We seek to create loving communities of kinship precisely to counteract mounting lovelessness, racism, and the cultural disparagement that keeps us apart. In the spring of 1993, when I am in internship, I find myself on a prison island in the Pacific Ocean off Mexico. Islas Marias, Mexico's Alcatraz, is a 12-hour barge ride from Mazatlan. The Jesuits celebrate 50 years of service there during my three-month stay. I live by myself, sleeping on a mattress in the sacristy of a small chapel in a remote part of the island called Camp Bugambilias, where nearly 800 colonos, or inmates, make bricks, tend livestock, and do a variety of other tasks of manual labor. Men are allowed to live with their families in simple bungalows, but the vast majority of the imprisoned are single men who live in dilapidated dorms. I make bricks with them all morning long, have mass in the afternoon, and play dominoes at night. We even put on quite an elaborate passion play during my brief stay. I eat with the colonos, and the food is unspeakably bad right out of the Dickens cookbook. Gruel does not do justice to what they slop on our plates. I lose 40 pounds. At brick making one morning, which by the way means we play in the mud, pour the stuff into wood slats, let it bake in the sun, then stack these tabique high to build walls. Beto, a daily mudslinger with me, tells me to meet him at noon at the lieutenant's garden. Bring your backpack should have been my first clue that we were headed for trouble. Beto is tremendo, mischievous, funny, in his mid-30s, always longing to dance right near the ledge of danger and dangle himself there in defiance of all reason. I've already seen him run afoul of the lieutenant, an exacting and spectacularly mean man who runs Camp Bugambilias. Beto, by the way, was excellent as Peter in our passion play. I meet Beto as planned, standing with my backpack, like a menso, I might add, outside the lieutenant's home. He has a flourishing vegetable garden, filled with all the things none of us had tasted in a very long time. Beto arrives, says, "Wait here," and kangaroos himself over the garden fence. Before I can get out, "What the hell are you doing?" Beto's snatching up carrots and tomatoes, peppers and lettuce. He's holding his T-shirt stretched in front of him, hopping down the aisles of the garden, tossing in zucchini, eggplant, and a couple of lemons for good measure. I'm in a panic. I have heard often of what passes as punishment in the camp. If a colono, for example, escapes to the mountains, leaving the island is unthinkable, too many sharks, the entire camp is given even worse food until they capture the inmate, who is carried into camp, tied on a stick, hanging from legs and hands like an iguana, and is soundly beaten.
I never witnessed any of this, but the stories are numerous. I only see the lieutenant's constant yelling and public humiliation of the colonos. I am doing some involuntary jig outside the fence, looking in all directions, and whining quietly, "Hurry! Hurry!" Beto leaps over to my side of the fence, looking 7 months pregnant, takes my backpack, thank you very much, and fills it with the purloined produce. "Let's go," he says, and hightail it we do. We run like crazy people to a spot Beto has set up a bit north of the dorm and secluded enough among the trees and the brush. He has a pot and starts a fire. He's been carrying a cloth sack that seems to have a life of its own. This is due entirely to the presence of a very large live iguana rustling inside. Catching iguanas is also strictly forbidden and punishable by beating with a very large stick. Beto guts the iguana, and it begins to simmer in the pot, and yes, it tastes just like chicken. I watch as he dexterously wields his knife around the carrots and slices and dices the other vegetables. I help where I can, stirring the concoction, but mainly staying out of Beto's way. He knows what he's doing. I admire his earnestness and the care with which he prepares our caldo de iguana. The aroma nearly brings tears to our eyes. I haven't smelled something so savory and delectable in a long time. It is longer still for Beto. As the smoke from lunch makes its way beyond the trees, we begin to receive visitors. A colono shows up and asks what we're up to. I watch Beto to see how he'll treat the intrusion. He tells the old man, "We're making caldo de iguana. Join us." I'm moved by the ease with which Beto lets this guy in and smoothly adds some water to the pot. The man tells us that he has something back in the dorm, and in short order he appears again with a small ball of crumbled old newspaper. He peels it open, and there is a clump of coarse salt he had been saving for just the right moment. Beto tosses it in. Shortly another uninvited colono shows up, and Beto again adds to the simmering pot some accommodating water and more vegetables. This inmate does the same retrieval of the safely guarded ingredient back in the dorm. This time, it's a slightly shriveled jalapeno pepper. It's diced, added to the mix. Another arrives, same inclusion, same retrieval. This guy has a rusted small can of tomato paste. Once they figure out how to open it, it too goes in. Maybe there are 8 of us or so when the meal finally gets served. Plenty to go around, and just as tasty as it could be. Everyone brought his flavor to this forbidden pot of iguana stew, and keeping anyone away and excluded was unthinkable to this band of prisoners. Alone, they didn't have much, but together, they had a pot full of plenty. No question gets asked of me more than, what's it like to have enemies working together? The answer, it is almost always tense at first. A homie will beg for a job, and perhaps I have an opening at the bakery. But you're going to have to work with X, Y, and Z, naming enemies already working there. He thinks a bit and invariably will say, "I'll work with them, but I'm not going to talk to them." In the early days, this would unsettle me, until I discovered that it always becomes impossible to demonize someone you know. I take 2 recently hired enemies, Artie and Danny, to Oakland for a talk I'm to give. They will man the table in the front and sell homeboy and homegirl merchandise. The trip is excruciating as they will not speak to each other. I carry the ball entirely in the conversation, and only occasionally do they grunt assent or nod, uh-huh. Before the talk, we're standing on the terrace at our hotel, overlooking a boardwalk along the water near Jack London Square in Oakland. We stand there in silence.